We're going to read from Colossians 1, which is on page 821 of your pew Bibles. So I'll give you a moment to get there. Verses 15 to 23 of Colossians 1. The Son is the image of the invisible God, the firstborn over all creation. For in him all things were created, things in heaven and on earth, visible and invisible, whether thrones or powers or rulers or authorities. All things have been created through him and for him. He is before all things, and in him all things hold together. And he is the head of the body, the church. He is the beginning and the firstborn from among the dead, so that in everything he might have the supremacy. For God was pleased to have all his fullness dwell in him and through him, to reconcile to himself all things, whether things on earth or things in heaven, by making peace through his blood shed on the cross. Once you were alienated from God and were enemies in your minds because of your evil behavior, but now he has reconciled you by Christ's physical body through death to present you holy in his sight, without blemish and free from accusation. If you continue in your faith, established and firm, and do not move from the hope held out in the gospel, this is the gospel that you heard and that has been proclaimed to every creature under heaven, and of which I, Paul, have become a servant.
Well, hey, my name's Tom. If I haven't met you before, I'd love to do that after we're done in here. Happy Mother's Day to you, if that's in your world at the moment. I actually haven't been doing much of this stuff recently because we had a baby ourselves, so we just had our second baby. She's 6 weeks old, so now I've got Ava, who's just turned two. She's really into baby chinos. That's her thing at the moment. And we've got Chloe, who's 6 weeks old. Her Mother's Day present to my wife, Bree, was that she only woke up once last night. So that was like a personal best. Good night for us. A couple of cheers from over here. Now, on Mother's Day, what we tend to do is to draw some kind of a link between wherever the passage is that we're up to at that time and Mother's Day itself. So I thought that we would do the meaning of life. The passage that we come to today is actually Colossians 1:16 particularly. It takes us to the very center of what we exist for. And when we do Mother's Day, we're thinking about bringing new life into the world. We're thinking about, you know, like, why even bring new life? What is the purpose of this life that I've been brought into the world with? And so we're going to have a look at the meaning and the purpose of life tonight. Let's get started. We've got a quote coming up on the screen from Ayaan Hirsi Ali. She wasn't always a Christian. She actually got born into a country with a certain form of Islam that she then rejected. She wrote a book about it, became quite a strong advocate of atheism and secularism, was in government in Europe, and recently has actually come to the Christian faith. And this is her reflecting on her secular era. She says this: atheism failed to answer a simple question, what is the meaning and purpose of life? A little bit closer to home, we had Hope Sunday a couple of Sundays ago. It was an epic day, packed it out, lots of people actually taking major steps forward in their faith. If that was you, we're so glad that you've come back tonight. And on that Sunday, we showed a video of Billy. Billy was saying very, very similar things. He said, I just struggled with meaning. I looked for it in all the wrong places. Taking us way back in philosophical history, this all connects to Socrates. So Socrates is famous for saying that the unexamined life is not worth living. The unexamined life is not worth living. There are lots of us, and we can just coast through life for a couple of years. You never really think about it. You just get on with enjoying it, maximizing what's in front of you. But for most of us, at some point, something will shake us. At some point, something will rock us. At some point, something will floor us. And it's only natural and normal to wake up and say, yeah, what is the purpose of it? What am I doing here? What is this world all about? On the flip side of what Socrates said, there's this train in Australian thought quite recently that would actually flip what Socrates has said on its head. It would say something like this: the examined life is not worth living. The examined life is not worth living. What we mean by that is, I don't want to think about the meaning and the purpose of life. That is way too heavy. That is way too out there. Like everyone else is just at home getting ready for the week to come or taking as much extra chill time as they can before Monday hits. I don't want to sit here and think about such enormous, overwhelming topics. I would rather just get on with life, because don't all the philosophers end up depressed anyway? The examined life is not worth living, is the train of thought. It was Heidegger, very famous philosopher from a couple of centuries ago. He came up with the idea that what differentiates humans from animals actually has a lot to do with the meaning and the purpose of life. Think about an animal for a second. They never wake up one day and say, what is all of this for? Animals spend a lot of time trying to escape the pain in life, but they're not at all concerned by the problem of life. That is a distinctly human experience. To be human is at some point to think about the big stuff. To be a thoughtful person in 2025 and not just sweep this stuff under the carpet is to be human. So what we're going to do tonight is we are going to think about the very purpose and meaning of life. I've got a couple of options for you. This is where people come to. This is a game of decode the icons, by the way. So if you can guess what it is before we get there, you get extra points. Top left will go across. Some people will take a strictly and a pretty crude evolutionary perspective. It goes like this, you know, I am just atoms bumping into other atoms. I am just the result of evolutionary process. So what is my meaning and purpose in life? To reproduce. That is my entire... And you think, gee, there must be something more than that. Like, is that actually it? On the flip side of that, people say, okay, what's the meaning and purpose in life? Second and third icons. Maybe it's happiness, my own happiness, or helping other people experience happiness. Or maybe it's love. And you say, well, those two words are great words. It's pretty hard to be against happiness, hard to be against love. But just think for a second. Is the meaning of life is happiness? Does that actually help you? The meaning of life is love. Can you be more specific? Can you actually say something that's going to help me in the moments when my life falls apart? Can you say something that's actually going to help me form a coherent way to live on this planet? How did we come to the idea that happiness is the meaning of life? It's probably kind of a hangover from the founding documents of the USA, where they say everyone's entitled to the pursuit of happiness. How did we come to the idea that love and love alone is the meaning of life? It's probably a hangover from the 60s. And it's kind of crept down into the way that we just default think today. Keep coming with me, bottom line. Some people, this is an original thought, I've borrowed this from other people. Some people today functionally, you'd never express it this way, but functionally, we live as if the meaning and purpose of life is to experience broadly. So think about a bad life, a narrow life, a tragedy of a life. You get born in one suburb and you never leave it. You only ever eat food from that one particular ethnicity that you come from. You never learn another language. You definitely never get on a plane and go overseas. And you never meet anyone outside of the 10 people who live immediately around your house. What a narrow existence. What a tragedy. Because what's the meaning and purpose of life? It's to experience broadly. Now, we've probably never articulated that before, but for a lot of us, we go, actually, I guess that is the founding principle behind a lot of my decisions at the moment. That is kind of what my life boils down to, experience broadly. Or how about this one? And this is a little bit close to home for Mother's Day. Family. For a lot of people, you say, hey, the meaning and purpose of my life is these people in my family. Now, on the one hand, that's beautiful. You say that the fact that you're looking beyond yourself, you're expressing love, when parents lay themselves down for a child, that's incredible. But this is also the world where helicopter parenting comes from. This is also the world where you see a parent whose meaning and purpose is so invested in their kid that they've just lost themselves. And you say, there must be more to... If my purpose in life is nothing more than Ava and Chloe, there's something missing from me. Final one. For a lot of us, we might say, you know what? The purpose of life is to have a positive impact on the world. And there's something noble about that. as well. I'd love for you to think today and actually recognize, now that we've warmed ourselves up a little bit, taken a very long introduction, we'll come all the way to Colossians chapter 1, verse 16. And I hope all of this helps us to see how interesting, how helpful, and how significant what the Apostle Paul is suggesting here about the purpose and meaning of life is in Colossians 1, 16. Here it is. For in him, this is Jesus, all things were created, things in heaven and on earth, visible and invisible, whether thrones, powers, rulers, authorities, all things have been created through him and for him. Paul is suggesting here that everything, including you and me, exists for Jesus. To put that into our language here today, what's the meaning and purpose of life, Paul? It is Jesus. Now, that is a very different way of answering the question. And if you're a Christian here today, that might still ring and sound a little bit unusual. It's actually not the first time in the Bible that that train of thought has come up. So Isaiah 43:7, this won't come up on the screen, but listen in. Isaiah 43:7 talks about everyone who is called by my name, whom I created for my glory. Now, this is shocking for a lot of us, that the God of the universe says that the purpose and meaning of my life, your life, is his glory. And you say, oh, there's something off-putting, there's something uncomfortable about that, because it sounds kind of arrogant, like is God up himself, is Jesus a jerk? Like for me, to say something like that would be absurd. What makes it okay for God? I thought God was supposed to be love, and now he's all this kind of egocentric thing going on. How does all of this work? You've really got to set your mind to it, but this will change the purpose and direction of the next 80 years of your life if you've got that many left. Here's how it goes. Imagine the God of the universe wants to give a gift to the people he's created. Parents love to give good gifts to their kids. They want to give the best gift. And God's thinking to himself, what is the gift I could give them? What is the thing that I could encourage them to center their lives around that would bring them the most meaning, the most purpose? And he thinks to himself, well, I could give them nature, all of it. That's a pretty good gift. I could give them the universe and they could look into it and peer into it and marvel at it. That'd be a pretty good gift. Maybe make it more tangible. I could give them each other as a tangible expression of my love for them. But think about it like this. For God to give us anything less than the biggest, the best, the central thing in the universe is to give us second best. And as crazy as it sounds, God gives us himself. God encourages us to give ourselves to the most worthy pursuit there is, which happens to be himself. Think about it like this. Sometimes people get into really small hobbies, like really niche things that nobody else cares about. And all they want to talk about the whole time is that particular little hobby, and just no one else cares, and their world becomes really small. You flip that with people who become interested in other people. They become interested in the world. They become interested in the big picture. And it has an enlargening effect upon you. What you choose to make the center of your world will change you. And it can either turn you into a small person or a very big person. Think about it like this. I would be very concerned if God, being some kind of tyrant who needed my praise to make himself feel good about himself, and then he says we've got to make it all about him, that would concern me. But think about the God who we actually encounter in the Bible. His main commandment is love the Lord your God with all your heart and soul and mind. Love your neighbor as yourself is like it. You want to bring the world together. You want to have a coherent vision for humanity. If you get everyone around that message, the world starts to pop in a really exciting way. I can deal with a God who's like that, a God who's others-centric, a God who's all love, telling me to make my world all about him. My question is, can you deal with that? Or does the world have to operate around you? Or is there someone who I've missed who it ought to operate around? This is life-changing stuff, if you can wrap your head around it. But I recognize it's pretty intense for a 6 p.m. on a Sunday, just before you've got to go back to what you do during the week. So there's our introduction. It's a long one, sorry about that. But what I plan on doing is just taking us through verse by verse through this passage that we have, and you'll know that we're getting towards a close when we start doing some visual illustrations. If you're a visual person in the room, you struggle with listening, tune in at the back end. You can take like a 4 minute break right now as we go through the passage. Verse 15, if you're an actual Christian, you actually want to read along. No. Shouldn't say that. Verse 15, it's on the screen. The sun is the image of the invisible God. That means you can know God. You can see him. How do you see him? In the sun. How do you get a good picture of the sun? Well, it's a good place to start is with his revealed scriptures that write all about him. You can see God. The sun is the image of the invisible God, the firstborn over all creation. Now, this is a classic place where people misunderstand what the Bible is saying. I misunderstood it the first time I read it. Firstborn. I have two kids. One's Chloe. She's 6 months, 6 weeks. One's Ava. She's 2 years old. So Ava is my firstborn. She got born before Chloe. But if you apply that logic to Jesus, you end up in pretty unhelpful territory, because now you've said that there was a moment when Jesus didn't exist, then he got born. And in that moment, you've actually stepped away from like all Christian thought that has basically ever happened. And when you really zero in on the scriptures and you try and understand the Trinity the way that God has revealed it to be, you come to the understanding that Jesus always existed. The second person of the Trinity, the Son, always existed. It was that he entered into our world in something like 0 AD. So here's the thing. You look at verse 16, right? And it clarifies what Paul actually means. He says, how can he be the firstborn over all creation? Well, for in him all things were created. So you go, okay, apparently in Jesus all things were created. He is the agent of creation. At the very least, you can say that he was there at the moment of creation. He's always existed. What this means is that there must be another meaning of firstborn. And that has a lot more to do with the idea of inheritance, or first among all of the siblings, or heir. Everyone who's like a firstborn kid right now is loving this. Everyone who's second and third, you're like, this sucks. But this is how they operated back then. This is the language of firstborn, is the idea that you're kind of out of all of the siblings, you're number one. Because what Paul is doing here, the whole way through this passage, is he's helping these new Christians in Colossae, that's roughly how you say it if you want, and he's asking them to get their heads around who it is that they've come to believe in. And he wants to lay out that Jesus is the biggest, Jesus is the top, Jesus is the everything. And it's like he's grasping at the limits of language, pulling in lots and lots of different terms to try and help us understand it. One of those terms is firstborn. And what I'd love for you to do in the next couple of verses is tune into all of the other terms that he uses to try and convey that Jesus is everything. Verse 16, for in him all things were created, things in heaven and on earth, visible and invisible, whether thrones, powers, rulers, authorities, all things have been created through him and for him. It's because he's the creator that he ought to be the purpose. Verse 17, he's before all things, and in him all things hold together. This is incredibly lofty language about Jesus. So take a pause with me for just a second. Have you ever thought to yourself or heard somebody say, Jesus never claimed to be God? Like maybe they just kind of exaggerated that in the future. Maybe it was like second century, third century, some kind of church councils needed to justify their own existence, so they built Jesus up to be bigger than he ever claimed to be. Maybe Jesus didn't really think of himself as being all that big of a deal. Here's the thing. The dating of this letter is incredibly helpful. When was this letter written? It's probably written in something like 60 AD, which means it's like 25, maybe 30 years after all the Jesus stuff went down. That's like somebody in 2025 writing about something that happened in 2000. It's very recent in terms of the big picture. And you go, whoa, this high language about Jesus, theologians call it a high Christology. This was happening in the first generation of Christians directly after Jesus. This is not a later invention, an exaggeration by future people. This was straight out of the gate saying Jesus not only was a kind of a cool miracle worker prophet guy, but this guy was there at the creation of the universe. In fact, everything was there. Everything exists for him. This is all straight out of the gate. Have a look at verse 18. Keep going. It says, he is the head of the body, the church. He's the beginning and the firstborn from among the dead, so that in everything he might have the supremacy. For God was pleased to have all his fullness dwell in him, and through him, verse 20, to reconcile to himself all things, whether things on earth, things in heaven, by making peace through his blood shed on the cross. Now this is fascinating, because you go, you've just spent quite a few words there, Paul, telling me how big of a deal this guy was. Apparently he's the creator. And then he said he died on a Roman torture device. He said that the creator spilled his blood, and somehow that affects the reconciliation of all things. We sung about this earlier in the service. How precious is the blood that makes me white as snow. Now come to verse 21 with me, because we're drawing towards a close. It says, once you were alienated, he moves to telling the Colossians their own story. He says, this is what happened to you when you came to faith. Once you were alienated from God and were enemies in your minds because of your evil behavior. But now he's reconciled you by Christ's physical body through death to present you holy in his sight without blemish and free from accusations. So we're getting to the end. Here come the visuals. What I want to do, if you're kind of new to the Christian stuff, by the way, you're just checking it out, you're about to hear the center of the Christian message from two different angles. You can see if either one of them resonates for you more than the other. If you have been a Christian for a long time, you might have found yourself trying to explain the key message of Christianity to other people and trying to grasp at some kind of simple analogy you can maybe pick between these two in your future chats. What I want to do is give you two angles on verse 22 that highlight different parts of what happens. Here's how the first analogy goes. It's really all about the bit that says, without blemish, free from accusation. This is a great analogy. It goes like this. Here's us, God's up there for the sake of the analogy, and we want to have a relationship with God. We want to be able to know him. We want him to listen to our prayers. We want to be able to hear from him. We want to be in a right relationship with the God who made us. But there is a problem, which is our sin. Our sin stands as a barrier, some kind of a wall between us and God. This is the record of all the things that we've done, thought, should have done, all the times that we've lived in God's earth without any recognition of him, or we knew what he wanted and we chose not to do it, or we actively avoided getting to know what he would want because we weren't going to do it anyway. It is a barrier between us and God. That's our problem. But our solution is the man Jesus Christ, the God-man, Jesus Christ. And he was the only one with no personal problem. He was the only one who didn't have his own record of sin that he had to deal with. And so he is equipped to take our sin. And he deals with it, which means that our relationship with God is now left with no problem, no barrier, nothing getting in the way, so that we can live in God's world with him as our Father, back in right relationship. It's a beautiful analogy. And what happens here is that we were full of blemish. We were full of accusation, but all of it is taken away by Jesus. Jesus takes our sin. Has anyone seen something like that one before? Show of hands. Seen something like that before? A couple of people. Excellent. I'd love to give you a second analogy. And this one, I think, is going to draw out a different part of verse 22. And I'm going to need a helper. So, Nikki, I didn't prep you, but can we go again? Is that okay? Ethan's got the shirts right next to him. Can we give Nikki a round of applause? Thank you so much. Now, Nikki, you get to be Jesus in this analogy. This has gone well for you. I'm going to be us. This is my garage shirt. It's the one I use to wipe up like all of the things that you really don't want to touch. And it has never seen a dishwasher. This is our record of sin. A dishwasher, a washing machine. That's where you wash clothes in. I'm a big boy. And this is our record of sin. And there might be parts of your life that you could say, oh, that bit looks probably not that bad. But as a whole, you go, gee, before God, I'm not doing great, am I? And if he actually is the holy ruler of the universe, I'm not in a great spot. But there was one person once, the God-man, Jesus Christ, who had no record of sin. And he's sponsored by Country Road. He's welcome at the great wedding banquet. His garment is clean. He is acceptable. He has no problem himself. Now, what happens on the cross is that all of my sin is given to Jesus. Jesus takes my sin, and now I am without blemish. I am free from accusation. Incredible. But here's the extra step, and you can see it in verse 22, that you become, if you put your faith in Jesus, holy in his sight. Theologians call this the great exchange, that what happens on the cross is a swap, not just a take. So here's the thing, Jesus is not just a taker, Jesus gives. Jesus is not just a taker, he gives you his record of holiness, righteousness, goodness, excellence, all of those words. He gives you his perfection. Thank you so much, Nikki, for doing this one. We can give a round. Here's where I'd love to finish, right? Pay attention in verse 22 to that phrase, in his sight. When God looks at you, when you're in his sights, how does he feel? Now you say, well, God is love, so he loves me. And I'll be like, yeah, it's totally true. I've learned something about marriage recently. For some of us, this is in the future. For some of us, this is like way in the past and you wish you'd known this like 20 years ago. This is judgment on Tom time. I learned something this week is that I used to think that if I told Bree, I love you, that was kind of everything covered because I'd use the biggest one. And I learned that there's other things you can say that might be helpful too. For example, you can say, I like you. So get this, actually lots of people in long-term relationships, you go, yeah, my partner loves me, but I'm not sure they like me right now. This is pretty real. Here's the thing, what does God think about you? For so many Christians, we say, yeah, he loves me, yeah. I want to ask you, does God like you? When he sees you, what does he see? What kind of feelings stir up in God's heart when he considers you? Because the incredible news of this passage here is that you become holy in his sight. Not just neutral, not just free from the bad stuff, but actively you've been given the good stuff that Jesus did. Did you live a life this week that was holy in his sight? Probably not. But are you clothed in his holiness? Absolutely you are, because Jesus gave it to you on the cross. In his sight, you are holy. Here's where this lands, and we're going to move towards a close. God is not disappointed at you. God is not patiently just putting up with you as a bit of a grudge. God is not disgusted by you. God is not annoyed at you. If you are a Christian and you have your faith in Jesus, Jesus has given you his holiness and you are not only free from blemish and accusation, you are actively, positively holy in his sight. When God looks at you, he says, that's my daughter and I love her. When God looks at you, he says, that's my son and I am proud of him. And that is more than just sentiment. Because what happened on the cross is that you are no longer full of blemish and accusation. It's been taken away, but Jesus doesn't just take. He also gives. And if you're a believer here today, you are actively clothed in the righteousness, the goodness, the holiness that Jesus earned by his life on the cross. So God does want to hear your prayers. He is towards you. He does want your good. And I take it that in his sight, you are pleasing. He is amped when you talk to him. He is not just putting up with you. Band, do you guys want to come up? We're going to sing about these things. I'm going to pray as well. If you want to join me, that'd be great. God, you're so good to us even when we're not good to you. Thank you for giving us clear purpose, clear meaning in a world where there's just so much confusion about that. God, thank you that when you look at us, you choose to view us positively. Thank you so much for what Jesus has done on the cross that makes all of that possible. God, I pray that for so many of us, and we might have walked in here feeling one way today, but we'll walk out feeling totally different. Please, for some of us who are far from you, draw us back to you. For some of us who are thinking about drawing away from you, would you hold us close? God, would you please encourage us, and would you please help us to worship you worthily right now as people who are pleasing and holy in your sight because of what Jesus did. And everyone who agreed said, amen.